headlines. The latest round of deadly bombardments by the Saudi coalition in Yemen draws the ire of many, including the UN chief.
Now, any bombardments that target civilians or that is not careful enough to protect civilians is, of course, also unacceptable.
Pro-Palestine activists converge outside Israel's London embassy, saying the regime's land grab projects must stop. And Beijing says Washington's decision to suspend dozens of flights by Chinese airlines is not guided by reason. Thank you for joining us. The top story this hour, Yemen's health ministry says the death toll from the Saudi-led coalition's latest airstrike on the country is likely to rise. The ministry says the toll now stands at 73, but it says many of the wounded who are in critical condition are likely to succumb to their injuries. Saudi warplanes bombed a prison in the northern city of Sa'da in the early hours of Friday, killing dozens of people. At least three children also died in a separate air raid on telecommunications facilities in the western city of Hodeidah. The attack led to a nationwide internet blackout. Earlier, we were joined by our correspondent in Sana'a, Abdul Latif al-Washili, to get the latest on the Saudi-led strikes. Here's more.
Unfortunately, the hospitals and the medical centers in Sa'da are facing a shortage of medical supplies, a shortage of power due to the shortage of fuel, which is caused by the Saudi coalition siege imposed on the country for years. Today, unfortunately, the world did nothing for the Yemeni people. They are being killed for 7 years. But when Yemenis defend themselves, when they attack Saudi or Emirati territories, we see the whole world talking about the attacks, condemning the attacks. While it's a legitimate right for the Yemeni people, they are defending themselves. They did not start the war. Saudis and Emiratis did start the brutal war on Yemen. The spokesman of the Yemeni army vowed Saudis and Emiratis of further attacks and coming attacks. He said that the United Arab Emirates is not safe anymore. As long as they are still attacking the Yemeni people, they are the Emiratis. Did try to isolate the Yemenis by targeting the international gate that supplies the whole of Yemen with internet connection and also with international calls, but they failed, I believe, as today most of the free media of the world, the free outlets, including Press TV, have revealed the brutality of the Saudis and Emiratis and their war crimes by targeting residential areas, killing more civilians, including children and Hodeidah.
Condemnations are pouring in over the Saudi-led coalition's deadly airstrikes on Yemen, with the UN chief describing the attacks as unacceptable.
Now, any bombardment that targets civilians or that is not careful enough to protect civilians is, of course, also unacceptable.
Antonio Guterres called for a prompt, effective, and transparent investigation into the airstrikes, which left dozens dead. Former leader of the UK Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn, also censured the attacks and called for an end to arms sales to Saudi Arabia. They said they make London a complicit in the Saudi crimes. Lebanon's resistance movement, Hezbollah, also condemned the raids as terrifying. It said the Saudi-led coalition's attacks are aimed at covering up its failure on the battlefield. Meanwhile, Iraq's resistance groups in separate statements denounced the airstrikes as a massacre of Yemeni civilians. Staying with news out of Yemen, a spokesman for the Yemeni army is warning foreign companies operating in the United Arab Emirates to leave the country amid an escalation of airstrikes. Yahya Sari says the UAE is no longer safe and investing there is highly risky for foreign firms. He says the UAE will remain unsafe as long as it continues to attack Yemen as part of a Saudi-led military coalition. The warning comes on the heels of a major drone strike by Yemeni forces deep inside the UAE last week. The retaliatory raid targeted three fuel tankers in Abu Dhabi, killing at least three people. Following the operation, the Saudi-led coalition launched hundreds of airstrikes on Yemen, hitting mainly civilian targets. Hundreds gathered outside the Israeli embassy in London on Friday to protest the Zionist regime's latest land grabs. Palestinians may lose their homes, but solidarity for their plights is growing. Bianca Rahimi tells us more from London.
Protesters outside the Israeli embassy have called for a boycott of Israel and those who support it, the delegitimization of the Zionist regime by Britain, which gave birth to it, and an end to apartheid.
We see you! We know your complicity, and we won't let you enable the ruthless and barbaric actions of the Israeli state in our name.
Israel is finding it more and more difficult to prevent the global community from knowing what's going on in the occupied territories. No amount of algorithms can stifle the cry for justice, and more people are standing in solidarity with the Palestinians.
For decades, Israel has been chipping away at Palestinian neighborhoods in East Jerusalem, Al-Quds. Now it's set its sights on Sheikh Jarrah. In May 2021, this neighborhood became an international focal point, with residents resisting expulsion using digital activism. The diaspora was galvanized, 180,000 people took to London's streets, and the land grab was postponed as a result. Londoners say the videoing of atrocities is working, but the Israeli lobby is strong.
Mona Al-Kurd, who is from Sheikh Jarrah, as she was transmitting the demolition of the garden center of the Salha family, her Instagram was blocked. So as far as we can, Palestinians and supporters try and portray to the world what is happening there. What we need to do is to find ways of turning that into a change in government policy.
The message is getting out. I'm of an age where I went first to Israel in the 60s, shortly after the Seven-Day War. People in this country did not know about Palestine. There was no understanding of the Nakba. There was no understanding of the expulsion of Palestinians. And for years and years, the Israeli government was allowed to continue, and this ignorance was perpetuated by the media.
Racism is a hot topic in the Western world, with people rising up against all forms of discrimination and inequality. And for many, Israel is synonymous with racism.
I think there are still organisations like the BBC which do not report what is going on the ground. Therefore, tools like social media are really, really important.
They're not going to get away with it. And as Martin Luther King said, the arc of history may be long, but it bends towards justice. We will win this fight, because justice will win.
Demolitions have begun, some in the dead of night. Stun grenades were used, the power cut, and dozens arrested. The ethnic cleansing continues, as does the fight to end the last apartheid on Earth. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Iran warns that Israel is exploiting the United Nations mechanisms and other international bodies to cover up its daily crimes against Palestinians. In a statement, Iran's foreign ministry stressed that the regime is, or has always tried to use the victims of crimes in the Second World War to justify its atrocities against Palestinians. The ministry said the regime has subjected Palestinians to all sorts of violations, especially crimes against humanity. It said genocide, terror, and ethnic cleansing are just some of the crimes the regime is committing against Palestinians. The ministry further stressed that Israel maintains the same racist and expansionist ideology that triggered the crimes committed during the Second World War. Tehran says Iran and Russia will have excellent cooperation in the new chapter of ties open to them after the Iranian president's visit to Moscow. In a tweet, Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian said he held important talks with his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov on Thursday. The Iranian top diplomat said they discussed construction of new nuclear power plants in Iran as well as all-out expansion of cooperation. Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi paid a two-day visit to Moscow this week. The presidents of Iran and Russia had assigned their foreign ministers to lay out a roadmap for mutual cooperation over the next two decades. Iran, China, and Russia have conducted a massive naval drill north of the Indian Ocean. The one-day maneuver engaged the latest naval equipment of the three countries with the aim of boosting coordination and synergy between their navies. Press TV's Youssef Jalali reports from the drill's location.
Russia's guided missile cruiser Varyag and its anti-submarine destroyer, the Admiral Tribute, paraded along Iranian and Chinese warships in Iran's southern territorial waters as the last phase of a joint naval maneuver codenamed Maritime Security Belt, conducted over 17,000 square kilometer area in north of the Indian Ocean. The one-day drill engaged some of the latest naval equipment of the three participating countries.
The Islamic Republic of Iran's Navy, together with the navies of the Russian Federation and the People's Republic of China, staged a joint drill with the motto of Together for Peace and Security. The ultimate goal of the exercises is to enhance the readiness of the three countries in confronting marine threats that are posed to civilian seafaring.
China's Urumqi destroyer and Iran's domestically built Dena and Jamaran destroyers were among the vessels that were deployed to the drills. The trilateral maneuvers saw the three navies practicing anti-piracy operations, where they freed two commercial ships from pirates. Iran's Navy says the drill will significantly boost the three countries' coordination and synergy in combating piracy and ensuring the safety of international shipping in the strategic Indo-Pacific region.
North of the Indian Ocean is of a special significance in terms of global trade. That's why it is associated with constant threats such as terrorism and piracy. Therefore, closer cooperation between the actors in this region promises safer maritime trade for all countries.
North of the Indian Ocean hosts more than half of the world's maritime oil trade, which pass through three strategic straits of Hormuz, Bab al-Mandeb, and Malacca, together forming what's known as the Golden Triangle of international trade. It's the third time Iran, China, and Russia are holding a joint drill in this body of water, with the aim to turn the thruway into a safe transit route for all passing ships. Iran, Russia, and China wrapped up their joint military exercises with strong messages. On top of them is their growing naval cooperation to ensure a collective security in the Persian Gulf, the Sea of Oman, and north of the Indian Ocean. This as they advised Western actors in the region to avoid destabilizing activities. Yusuf Jalali from the location of the drills.
China and the United States are at odds again, this time on the suspension of each other's flights. The U.S. has suspended 44 flights by Chinese carriers, with the Transportation Department saying the move is in response to a similar decision by China. In recent weeks, Beijing suspended 44 flights by American Airlines after detecting positive COVID cases. Now the Chinese embassy in Washington says such policy has been applied equally to Chinese and foreign airlines in a fair, open, and transparent way. The embassy says the U.S. measure is unreasonable, urging Washington to stop disrupting normal passenger flights. The two countries are at loggerheads on other issues, including the coronavirus origin, as well as trade and politics. Earlier, Andrew Leung, an independent China specialist, joined us with his take on rising China-U.S. tensions. He says the two top economies are divided not only on politics and economy, but any issue, you name it.
U.S.-China confrontation, or rivalry, or competition, is now all over the place, you know, 360 degrees. It's not only trade, but technology, South China Sea, Taiwan, Xinjiang, Hong Kong, you name it. But the unfortunate thing is that the United States seems to be increasingly unreasonable. In other words, their actions are dictated more by attitude rather than by reason. As pointed out, the Chinese suspension of flights is based on the discovery of COVID cases, and that applies to other airlines, regardless of origin. But where is the United States in the Trump and in the Biden administration, with the midterm elections coming up? Everything about China needs to be pushed against, regardless of reason, and that informs this, tit for tat suspension of flights. But also, if you look at what the United States is doing in the South China Sea, in technology, and the reactions are bouncing back, hurting America, for example, by sanctions imposed on a lot of Chinese goods, is stoking U.S. inflation.
The Russian foreign minister has once again dismissed Western claims that Moscow was planning to invade Ukraine. Sergei Lavrov made the remarks after a high-stakes meeting with his U.S. counterpart, Antony Blinken, in Geneva.
I would like to reiterate once again At the end of our meeting, we agreed that next week the US is going to present us with written answers to all of our proposals. And you also said, in particular, that Ukraine has represents no threat to Russia. And I would like to once again remind everyone who analyzes our public statements and our analysis, and I would like to say that never before has Russia threatened through its official representatives the Ukrainian people.
Lavrov said talks with Blinken were open and useful. He added that Russia is concerned about weapons and Western military experts being sent to Ukraine, accusing NATO of working against his country. The U.S.-Russia meeting comes amid rising tensions over Ukraine. The U.S. and its allies say Russia is planning to use over 100,000 troops deployed near the Ukraine border for an invasion. Russia, in turn, accuses the West of plotting provocations in Ukraine. Russia wants binding security guarantees, including a permanent ban on Ukraine's membership in NATO. The U.S. and the military alliance have rejected the demand, warning that any attack on Ukraine would have costly consequences.
We've been clear. If any Russian military forces move across Ukraine's border, that's a renewed invasion. It will be met with swift, severe, and a united response from the United States and our partners and allies.
Antony Blinken described his discussions with Lavrov as frank and substantive. He said the U.S. and its European allies stand firmly with Ukraine in support of its sovereignty and territorial integrity. Blinken also vowed a decisive, calibrated, and united response to any non-military Russian aggression, including cyber attacks and paramilitary tactics. He said the U.S. is prepared to pursue possible means of addressing Russian concerns in the spirit of reciprocity. Blinken reiterated he hadn't expected Washington and Moscow to resolve their differences in the meeting, but hoped to keep a diplomatic path to addressing those issues open. That's your world news for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian has once again reaffirmed that Tehran has no intention of wasting time or derailing the sanctions removal talks in the Austrian capital Vienna. We have prepared for you an article written by Faiz Akbar-Shahi, an international relations expert. The piece is titled, Iran's Logic and Broken U.S. Master Key in Vienna Talks. Only over 130 days were enough for the United States to realize that Iran is serious in the Vienna negotiations and wants to remove nuclear and sanction disputes with the West. On 29th of July 2021, a week before the administration of President Said Ebrahim Raisi took office in Tehran, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said the negotiating process cannot go on indefinitely. On 30th of November 2021, after the conclusion of the first round of talks, he stated, We still believe diplomacy is the best path forward for putting the nuclear program back in the box it had been under the 2015 nuclear agreement, officially known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA. On January 10th, Mohammad Marandi, an advisor to the Iranian negotiating team in Vienna, said the Western side is seeking to prolong the negotiations. Over the course of 131 days, only two rounds of negotiations took place, but the remarks by Anthony Blinken and Mohammad Marandi show that there are events underway in Vienna which are not covered by the media. American political history shows that Democrats have a thirst for keeping busy. In their view, there is no master key, and each case and subject had its own requirements. Republicans, on the other hand, do not like the fuzzy logic system and look at things in terms of ones and zeros. Remember comments by former US President George W. Bush, who called the world either with us or against us, and Donald Trump, who has always embodied good and evil in diplomatic equations. However, in the face of Iran, US President Joe Biden does not want negotiations only to resolve nuclear and sanction disputes with Iran. He is trying to seize the opportunity provided by the talks to get concessions from China and Russia. But now, Joe Biden's master key is broken, and he has no alternative plans other than doubling sanctions. On the other hand, the European trio is dragging its feet, wasting time and avoiding commitments to the JCPOA while attempting to redraw the equations in such a way that, first of all, the US interests are not harmed by the multilateral nuclear accord. As Iranian scholar Abu Muhammad Asgharkhani has said, the Republicans were seeking to swiftly contain Iran and withdrew from the JCPOA so that the Europeans could keep the Islamic Republic within the JCPOA prison. In this regard, the US appreciation for the measures taken by the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, and the European trio concerning Iran's nuclear case is meaningful. The Europeans are also trying to advance the negotiations mechanism in such a way as to get concessions from both China and Russia. The rifts between Germany, Britain and France on the one side and the European Union on the other side shows that the European Troika views negotiations with Iran even as a profit-making platform that makes the post-Brexit system meaningful. The differences between the narratives of Enrique Mora and Josep Borrell, who represent the European Union's strategy, and those of the three European countries the European Troika envoys proves this proposition. On this basis, it can be expected that the expressed differences will emerge if Iran continues to adhere to its position, especially with respect to the verification of sanctions removal and guarantees that the US would not abandon the agreement once again. The politicization of the IAEA's work, the emphasis on the nuclear breakout, the negotiations with the Zionist regime in the middle of the Vienna talks, and of course the discussions with South Korea and Saudi Arabia, all demonstrate that the opposite side has not benefited from driving a wedge between Iran, China and Russia. Blaming Tehran, imposing a deadline and even prolonging the negotiation process. It thus wants to face Iran with more diverse incentives and threats so that the country feels it needs a minimum deal, something that was previously called a temporary agreement. Rendering the aforesaid techniques ineffective stems from an innovative Iranian approach in the last two rounds of negotiations. Firstly, Iran tried to advance the nuclear issue technically and properly recognize the demands of the other side through the smart separation of the overt and covert layers of the negotiations. Secondly, Iran keeps insisting that in the first place it separates its economy from its foreign policy as much as possible. And secondly, it does not restrict its entire foreign policy to the case of negotiations with the 4+1 group. The time is ripe for increasing the source of power, and this is the point in the course of the negotiations where both bilateral and multilateral diplomacy is active. Iranian missiles are tested, and Iran's oil revenues are approaching pre-JCPOA levels. Recently, Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian has once again reaffirmed that Tehran has no intention of wasting time or derailing the sanctions removal talks in the Austrian capital Vienna, criticizing the West, particularly the United States of America, for failing to present any innovative proposals of its own in the negotiations in Vienna. Amir Abdollahian made the remark in an interview with China Global Television Network, CGTN, before wrapping up his official visit to Beijing at the invitation of his Chinese counterpart, Foreign Minister Wang Yi. He said, "We assured Chinese officials that Iran is not playing with time or trying to derail the negotiations, and that we have made constructive, positive, and realistic proposals at the negotiating table in Vienna." Amir Abdollahian hailed China's constructive and rational role in the Vienna negotiations, saying, "Beijing is always opposed to the cruel unilateral sanctions imposed by the United States on countries including Iran and condemns the bullying practices of the United States." The Iranian foreign minister added that in talks with his Chinese counterpart Wang Yi, he appreciated Beijing's support for Tehran's stance during the Vienna talks and expressed hope that China would continue to support Iran's position. Amir Abdollahian emphasized that China and Russia support Iran's constructive initiatives, but Western countries, including the United States, have so far offered no innovative proposals of their own in the Vienna talks. Amir Abdollahian said, "If the parties can resume their commitments under the Iran nuclear deal, Iran will also return to commitments based on the agreement. If Iran can get the expected economic benefits from the agreement, so will all the parties to the agreement." Iran also argues that lack of initiative among the Western parties to the Vienna deal is the main factor slowing down the talks in Vienna. Addressing a regular press conference on Monday, the Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson, Zhao Lijian, voiced his country's strong opposition to illegal and unilateral sanctions against Iran and gross interference in the internal affairs of the Islamic Republic and other countries of the region.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. Saudi Arabia has intensified its airstrikes on Yemen, killing dozens of civilians in its latest air attacks, that is, on two key cities. A frenzied bombing campaign comes amid the Yemeni army's successful retaliatory operations and major advances made against the Saudi and Emirati-backed militants. What are the consequences of the recent escalation for the region and beyond? And where is the deadly war heading for? These are some of the issues that we'll try to discuss in this edition of Spotlight.
Yeah.
There's no end in sight to the Saudi-led aggression against Yemen. Riyadh and its allies commit yet another inhumane crime amid the deafening silence of the United Nations and other international bodies and so-called advocates of human rights. Saudi warplanes bombarded the western city of Hodeidah and a detention center in the northern city of Saada within hours. Dozens of people, including children, were reportedly killed in Saada alone. The overnight strike on Hodeidah also left several casualties, most of them children. The strikes triggered a nationwide internet blackout in the country. The Norwegian ambassador to the United Nations, whose country holds the presidency of the UN Security Council for January, has reacted to the strikes.
New attack or series of attacks is at least 60 dead, maybe as many as 100. I mean, that can't be acceptable, can it?
No, I mean, it's not acceptable, and we absolutely call for restraints on all sides.
On Friday, thousands of Yemenis staged a rally in Sana'a to denounce the latest deadly airstrikes. The protesters condemned the United States for arming and backing Riyadh and its allies in the war on Yemen. The coalition has stepped up airstrikes against Yemen in recent weeks, killing dozens of civilians, including children.
Now we have become afraid day and night and in the morning. You don't know when the strikes will happen. The homes of citizens are now military targets, and this is what we fear. You fear that you will take children to school or to the hospitals or something like that, and you will get hit.
The spike in Saudi-led aggression follows Yemen's successful operation deep inside the UAE, in retaliation for its role in the Saudi-led onslaught. During the operation, several sensitive locations in Dubai and Abu Dhabi, such as airports and oil refineries, were targeted with drones and ballistic missiles. Saudi Arabia and its allies, including the UAE, launched a devastating war on Yemen in 2015 in an attempt to reinstate a friendly regime there. The kingdom has also maintained a blockade on Yemen ever since it began the war, while the impoverished country is in dire need of basic supplies such as food and medicine. Years of bombing and blockade have left hundreds of thousands of Yemenis dead and displaced millions of them. The impoverished country is experiencing what the UN has described as the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
Well, joining us on this edition of The Spotlight, we have activist and political commentator Hossein Al-Buhaidi, who is joining us from the Yemeni capital, Sana'a. And we also have Ken Stone from the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War, who is with us from Hamilton, Ontario.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, let's start off with Mr. Al-Buhaidi in Sana'a. Let's discuss the recent increased Saudi-led airstrikes on Yemen. Give us your assessment of the targets and the consequences of the recent escalation for the security of the region.
First of all, this is not the first time that the Saudi target a prison. The casualty of the latest attack on Saada prison has reached 223, including about 85 dead. And they have targeted before a prison in Hodeidah, killing and injuring hundreds, and as well in the Damar city, they have targeted a prison which was prisoners of war were held there, killing and injuring more than 300. So that's why this latest attack shows that the Saudi, and especially United Arab Emirates, because they have failed to target the Yemeni army forces in the battlefield, either in Shabwa or in Marib, they have trying to take revenge from the Yemeni civilians. There is no fuel. There are less cars on the street, maybe 80% less than normal. The fuel price has increased. It used to be 8,000 riyal for 20 liter. It costs now almost 30,000 riyal because Saudi and UAE, backed by the United States and UK, has blocked fuel ship from entering Hodeidah port. And those latest attacks show how weak is the United Arab Emirates. They couldn't actually protect their country. They should expect that Yemeni army will launch more attack against them, because as long as they target Yemen, as long as they keep targeting civilians, enforcing the blockade, supporting separatists and militia and terrorist group on the ground, Yemeni army has the full right to target United Arab Emirates. And I believe maybe in the coming hours there might be a huge attack on United Arab Emirates. And here in Sana'a, they have advised foreign company and as well flight company who are working in Abu Dhabi and as well in Dubai, they should stop using those airports, because after the latest attack, and as Al-Amid Yahya Sari', the spokesperson of Yemeni army, has announced that United Arab Emirates is unsafe state. That's why I believe any civilian casualty, if it will happen in next attack on United Arab Emirates, that the United Arab Emirates bear the full responsibility, and as well the foreign company. Because if it was any other airport in Europe or in the US, if there was a small incident, the entire airport will be shut down. But I believe that United Arab Emirates will not do that, and they will not stop their war against Yemen unless Yemeni will launch a huge attack, because they have the means, they have the weapons to do that. And now Sana'a will bear some of the responsibility of those civilians that are killed today and during the seven years of the war and blockade in Yemen,
right?
Because they have now the will and they have the equipment to target United Arab Emirates.
Let's bring in Mr. Ken Stone in the discussion. The Yemeni army launched retaliatory drone attacks deep inside the United Arab Emirates on Monday, as alluded to by our guest in Sana'a. The attack by the Yemeni army on the UAE sent a message to the aggressors that the attacks resulting in civilian deaths in Yemen will not go unanswered. How much, in your opinion, can these reprisal attacks change the dynamics of the war?
I think the reprisal attacks can very much change the dynamics of the war. When the war started, the Saudi coalition, which includes the U.S. and the U.K. and is backed up by arms sales from, unfortunately, my own country, Canada, thought that it would be a matter of months or weeks even, and the Yemeni people, who are from the poorest country in the Arab world, would cave in and give up. But instead, the Yemeni people have rallied to protect their national sovereignty and territorial integrity, and they have not only resisted the illegal war of aggression by the Saudi coalition, but they have managed, against all odds and with tremendous courage, to take the fight right back into Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. They are taking the war back to where the aggressors live, and they are hitting important installations such as their oil facilities and airports and so on. Of course, it's always regrettable when civilians are killed in war, but the people who bear the responsibility, the ultimate responsibility for the deaths of civilians, are the people who start the war of aggression. This was established 70 years ago at the Nuremberg War Crimes Tribunal. The party which starts a war of aggression bears the responsibility for all the evils of war, the deaths, the destruction, the rape, the murder, everything else. And so we must lay the blame on the aggressors here, the Saudi coalition.
Right. Hossein Al-Bukhaiti, the Yemeni army also released footage of operations against Saudi and UAE-led mercenaries and Daesh terrorists in Shabwa province. another example of Yemeni victories on the ground. Do you think the Saudis have underestimated the defensive capabilities of the Yemeni forces?
Yes, they did, because we remember General Al-Asiri, the previous spokesperson of the Saudi-led coalition, has announced after 3 weeks of starting the war and blockade on Yemen that they have destroyed between 90 and 95 of Yemeni military equipment and ballistic missiles and others. And they used to conduct hundreds of airstrikes a day. About 200,000 airstrikes has been conducted against Yemen since the beginning of the war. And you can imagine all those airstrikes, they have not stopped the capability of Yemeni army and armed force to attack and target Saudi Arabia. And this shows exactly that the Saudi Arabia and UAE coalition strike on Yemen, they mainly target civilians as the latest attack. Just in the last three days, they have targeted Sana'a, killing about 20 civilians, 12 of them from one family. They have targeted Al-Ain Hospital 2 days ago in Shabwa, killing and injuring several patients and doctors in there. And I don't know why they have actually wasted that amount of fighter jets and as well of rocket and missiles that might cost hundreds of thousands of dollars to target civilians. I mean, they could actually focus on the battlefield. They could focus on Marib and on other area. But they think that those type of attack will have pressure on Yemeni civilians. They want to bring Yemenis to submit to this Saudi coalition war on Yemen. But I believe that more attack like that on civilians, it will result in more people joining the Yemeni army to try to fight face-to-face with the Saudi-backed forces in many areas in Yemen. And I believe if Yemeni army will continue its attack, especially against United Arab Emirates, that United Arab Emirates, because of its reputation, and many companies work there, most of their income is coming from tourists and from foreign companies and importing and exporting and oil. So if they focus the attack, if they continue the attack, I don't think that this war will continue. And just last thing, what add insult to injury is that UN Security Council and the United Nations, they have condemned the attack on United Arab Emirates. They have condemned that Yemeni army has seized that United Arab Emirates flag ship, which was carrying weapons. But on the other hand, they have not condemned any attack or strike that kills civilians.
Ken Stone, if none of Riyadh's objectives have been met, does this mean, is it safe to deduce that the Saudis are worse off now more than ever over the course of the 7 years of the war?
Absolutely. They are losing the war in Yemen, and they have lost the war against Syria. So the Saudi royal family has waged two wars, which they are losing badly. And I think this will come back to haunt them. I think this will also come back to haunt the monarchy in the United Arab Emirates. And I do want to take up the point of your other guest as well. It is shameful that the United Nations, which mourned the loss of civilian life in the recent attack on UAE, has not come out and done the right thing, for which it was set up in 1945 to end the scourge of war. It should have labeled the Saudi coalition as the aggressor and taken action, collective action, against the coalition itself. But that does not mean that the people who are your listeners around the world can't do anything because the UN has failed to act appropriately. They need to put pressure on their governments to cease any arms sales to any part of the Saudi coalition. In Canada, we have had a number of demonstrations at plants and in front of members of parliament's offices demanding an end to arms sales to Saudi Arabia. And many, apparently, our colleagues in other countries have done the same, because many countries in Europe have said that they will not anymore sell arms to the Saudi coalition. And I applaud those people and those countries in Europe that have taken that position. But more needs to be done in this regard. And I wish also to mention our own foreign minister, Madame Joly, who just the other day in two tweets said that Canada strongly condemns the civilian deaths in the UAE, and her thoughts are with the victims, and she called on the Houthis to stop their attacks. Well, you know, I have been following this war for 7 long years now, and I cannot remember one time, one occasion, when the Canadian foreign minister has ever said that their thoughts went with the victims of the Saudi coalition attacks in Yemen. And there weren't just 3 victims in Yemen. There are now 377,000 victims of the Saudi coalition attacks in Yemen. And where is our foreign minister when this happens?
Mr. Abu-Haiti, there were massive demonstrations in Yemen. Thousands of Yemenis rallied in Sana'a to denounce the recent deadly airstrikes by the Saudi-led coalition. Are we seeing the resistance front gaining more and more support as each day goes by and as each attack takes place?
Yes, of course, because each attack conducted and strike conducted by the Saudi-led coalition, especially when it kills Yemeni civilians, many people will join the battlefield, because they have this clearly now that what the Saudi want in Yemen is not that, as they call, to bring security to Yemen or to bring Hadi legitimacy. We've seen what's happening in the south with the United Arab Emirates creating separatists, using terrorist group to fight Sana'a forces. And this is a clear, the protest today is a clear message that the United States is behind this. I mean, even though that the Biden administration has said that they will stop the sales of weapons to Saudi Arabia, but they haven't done any of that. And the latest attack and strikes on Yemen shows that it is with the help of the United States. And many countries, of course, they have condemned the attack against United Arab Emirates, especially countries from Arab nations who are involved in this war in the Saudi coalition. United Kingdom, France, and U.S. and Canada, they are making billions of dollars, tens of billions of dollars in profit from this war. And it's really, really shameful for United Nations and UN Security Council, and as well other countries, that they are worried about what they say, the security of the region, the security of Saudi Arabia. I mean, what about the security of Yemen? What about hundreds of thousands of Yemeni civilians, most of them are children, that has been killed by this war, either by direct airstrike or blockade? I mean, Yemen is in Yemen, it's not on the moon, it just have border with Saudi Arabia, and it's close to United Arab Emirates. So the security, what Sana'a now want to send a clear message, that the security of Yemen is a part of the security of United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia and the region. And if those countries will not stop what they have created in Yemen, the fire that they have created and the fight that they have created, it will be brought to those two countries. And I believe that this is the only action that can stop this war, because we should not anymore believe in the United Nations, because they have been exposed from the beginning of the war in Yemen, and as well in Syria and in other countries.
Mr. Ken Stone, there's another alarming angle to all of this, as there may be another entity that's willing to participate in the bombing of Yemen, and that's the Israeli regime. Israel has announced that it will come to the aid of the UAE and support any military action against Yemen. Do you believe Israel's intentions are for the safety of the UAE, or is the regime pursuing its own ulterior motives?
Well, let's remember that the UAE and several other Arab governments recently opened up formal relations with the apartheid state of Israel. And this didn't really change anything. It just brought into the open what they've been doing in secret all along, and that is collaborating with the state of Israel to maintain U.S. hegemony over the entire region. The state of Israel, along with the UAE and the Saudi monarchy, are the main bases of the main pillars of U.S. domination over the region. And so it's no surprise to me that Israel says that they're planning to get involved. I believe they are already involved. I can't believe that they wouldn't be, because they have their dirty hands in every war of the U.S. empire, whether it's in Syria or Iraq or Afghanistan. It doesn't matter. They're in there like a dirty shirt. The purpose of this war was from the very start to maintain U.S. hegemony over the strategic and oil-rich Middle East. And despite what Biden said 1 year ago in February that the U.S. would not support. They wanted to see an end to the war in Yemen, and they would not support offensive military operations. They would cut their trade deal, their arms deals with the Saudis if the war continued. Still, the war is going ahead because the strategic aim remains the same, which is to say, to keep U.S. hegemony. And I don't think that the people of Yemen have any other alternative but to resist this illegal war and take the war back into the capitals of those Arab countries that are waging the war in order to put a price for the war on those aggressor countries such that they drop out of this war. And
okay.
I believe that they need to do so.
Okay, we're short of time. Let's get a final thought in from Mr. Al-Bukhaiti. It's been reported that the UAE is setting up an espionage center for the Israeli regime at Socotra Airport in southern Yemen. Will Israeli cooperation, in your opinion, lead to the regime's wider military participation in the conflict?
I don't think any involvement from the Zionist state will make any difference, because United Arab Emirates had a great relation with the Zionist state of Israel from the beginning of the war. Of course, it was secret relation. From the beginning of the war, I believe that the Zionist state was helping United Arab Emirates and Saudi, and some of the airstrike at the beginning of the war that was conducted with those huge bombs that targeted Sana'a, killing and injuring hundreds of Yemeni civilians. I believe that those could be a fighter jet from Israel or as well from the United States. And I think the latest relation or open relation between United Arab Emirates and Israel is because United Arab Emirates want to get the Zionist state of Israel more involved in this war. But I'm sure the attack against United Arab Emirates and Saudi and direct attack against older infrastructure like airport and port, I think this is the only way to stop the war against Yemen.
All right. Thanks a lot, gentlemen. Activist and political commentator Hossein Al-Bukhaiti joining us from the Yemeni capital, Sana'a. And thanks to Ken Stone from the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War, joining us from Hamilton, Ontario. And a special thanks to you for staying with us on tonight's edition of The Spotlight.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program The Key here at IRIB English Radio. Thank you for joining us here today. Today we're going to be talking about a question that's often posed by a lot of people, and that's this. Is it an innovation in religion, a bid'at in religion, for us to mourn the death and the martyrdom of the friends of God, such as the Imams alayhim as-salam and the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, or even other religious figures who we believe are close to God? In response to this question, we can say this, that first of all, when we look at the term bid'at and examine it, we see that bid'at is used in contrast to the word sunnat. We see this used in contrast to the word sunnat in the traditions. This indicates the fact that a bid'at is something which doesn't have any basis and foundation in the sunnat and the tradition of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. Therefore, if we say that crying for these friends of God and mourning them is an act of bid'at, it would mean that it has no basis and foundation in the sunnat of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam or the companions of the Prophet Rizwanullah ta'ala alayhim. This is not true. When we look at the tradition and the sunnat, we clearly see instances of cases where the Prophet mourned people who were dear to him. And the companions did the same thing. They even cried for them. The Prophet cried for these people. Today we're going to mention a lot of some cases of this in order to reinforce what we're saying. For example, in Sahih Bukhari, volume 2, page 549, we read the following hadith and tradition that the Prophet ﷺ was found sitting on beside the grave of one of his daughters who had passed away. No, I'm not talking about the daughter of the Prophet, the Lady Fatima, another of his daughters who had passed away. We saw him sitting by the grave, and the person narrating this tradition says that I saw his eyes full of tears and shedding tears. This is one tradition narrated in one of the compendiums of the traditions of the Holy Prophet. In another tradition, we see that has been related that the Prophet said the following when his son Ibrahim passed away. The Prophet has been narrated to have said that surely the eye sheds the tears and the heart is saddened, but we do not say that but which our Lord is satisfied with. And surely we are sad by your passing, O Ibrahim. This is a very famous tradition. It has been narrated again in Sahih Bukhari in the same place on page 556. This is a very clear and explicit indication that it's okay and permissible to be sad and to cry upon the deaths of God's friends and His chosen ones. In another tradition, it has been also narrated that the Prophet cried and encouraged people to cry on the death of the famous martyr of Islam, Hazrat Hamza. This is a very long tradition. To mention it in brief, the Prophet encouraged this act, and this indicates that it's permissible to cry for the friends of God. Inshallah, maybe we can elaborate on this tradition further in some subsequent sessions of the key. Until next time, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to EnglishRadio at irib.ir.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The eighth round of talks aimed at saving the agreement known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, between Iran and world powers, is steadily moving on. The Iranian delegation led by Deputy Foreign Minister Ali Bagheri Kani has been in constant meetings with representatives of the three European signatories of the deal, Britain, France and Germany, EU coordinator Enrique Mora, as well as the Russians and the Chinese. Progress has been reported on talks concerning Iran's nuclear commitments, but there are still differences when it comes to the removal of US sanctions and the Iranian demands for verification and guarantees. Tehran says it wants assurances the US will not withdraw from the agreement again or reimpose sanctions. European and American diplomats have been voicing their concerns about the pace of the talks. An advisor to the Iranian team, Professor Mohammad Marandi, says the only reason progress is slow is because the Americans are resisting the notion that they have to give up sanctions.
I think the most important thing is that the Americans and the Europeans have still failed to remove sanctions or agree to remove many key sanctions. That is simply unacceptable for Iran. If the Iranians are going to put a cap on elements of its nuclear program, there has to be a change, of a clear change in the eyes of ordinary Iranians with regards to the sanctions regime. It has to